Well, about a dozen people provided public input centered on the standards-based grading program currently being piloted at Ecker Hill Middle School. Parent input was overwhelmingly opposed, while teachers supported the new standards. In the studio with an update on that, I have Park City School Board President Andrew Kaplan, and we're hoping the superintendent will join us here shortly. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Leslie.
So you've received comments from constituents saying that they're confused and frustrated and feel like the program isn't going well. They're worried because high-performing students may not be satisfied or motivated by this rating system, which basically outlines competency rather than performance. You've also heard from parents saying that they don't even know what a 4 rating is or how their kid can achieve it. On the other hand, teachers feel the opposite. So why are we doing this?
Yeah, so I think what we really need to do is break, standards reference grading or standards-based grading down into two parts. One is the, kind of the academic justification and reason for it. And there's a lot of work that's been done nationwide by educators that shows that, teaching students mastery or to standards is better for them, as opposed to teaching them to a test, right, or to an assignment. And, the idea is learning a concept as opposed to striving for perfection on a specific grade or an exam and then moving on and forgetting that. So there's, it's a movement that's not new to us either as a district. People will be familiar with this style of grading in the elementary years where teachers focus on mastery rather than students trying to achieve perfection on a given subject or a lesson plan. So that's the academic background of it. And then where we've really run into some issues this year is with the implementation of a new grading system at Ecker. And that was brought on by, a technology kind of update to our grading system, PowerSchool. They've decommissioned that and now they're going with PowerSchool Plus. So it's a new system. And because we were trying out Ecker was going to try out this new system, they decided, okay, let's try to implement standards-based grading as a trial and see how that goes. Now, where we ran into issues, I think, a number of spots. One is that we didn't really have enough time for professional development so that there were, that there were no questions from our educators. We didn't have enough time to really go out to all of the parents and explain how the system was going to work. And I think with any new system, you learn kind of on the job in some cases. And we learned that, okay, maybe the 1-4 grading system isn't the most efficient. And so these are all things that happen when you pilot a program. They're all things that, as I've learned, when you're dealing with education, implementation is a very difficult thing. And as we all know, when you're dealing with change of any sort, especially with communicating to students and their parents how their achievement looks, it's very stressful and causes anxiety and confusion. So that's where we are.
So it is the case then that teachers are teaching or giving some students one test, other students another test at the same time?
Well, I think what we found is there's there's a lack of consistency in the implementation from a grading perspective, and there are some inconsistencies in the on the testing side and evaluation. And I think I'll let the superintendent speak to that, but we have growing pains, so to speak, in terms of getting from where we are to where we want to be. And right now in the district, I think we have 16 different ways of grading.
Yeah, so do we?
So it's we know 16 is too many. There's no perfect number, but we know that's too many. And what we're trying to do is have the student experience from K to 12 have a little bit more consistency from year to year and from school to school so that it eventually eases the anxiety and the confusion of grading and the way that people are learning.
So Jill, does the district have a policy on grading? I mean, if we have a policy on grading, why are we having 16 different ways of grading?
Right, so you have, if you think of a college campus where each instructor gives you a syllabus that describes how you're grading, that is basically the current way of thinking about grading at Park City. So as long as the teacher communicates how they're grading to the students, that is that has been sufficient as part of just the background of teachers. So it's not uncommon, but boy, I think when you move from a silo to a system, I think you can get better results. And so I think as President Kaplan explained, you know, there are some of those adjustments when you shift a system.
Okay, so how is the board going to decide then what happens with the new program? I mean, do you vote to say that this is...
No, I mean, look, I think there's a policy option. You know, when you ask the question, do we have a policy on grading, you know, not specific to demanding that there's a certain curve in every class. I mean, our job as a board is not really to tell educators how to teach or manage that. I think, you know, the board is focused on a very specific aspect, as are the parents, which is the reporting of grades and of achievement. And we have you know, we want all of our students to reach their academic potential. This is one of the reasons why, you know, this program appeals to educators, right, is that it allows students to reach their potential. But there's a lot of things, a lot of kinks that we need to work out. And what we're hearing consistently is, yeah, we want to make sure that our highest achieving kids are challenged. You know, when we talk about equity for all students, that includes our highest achieving kids. And if they're not able to reach their academic potential, we're not doing our job. So we need to focus on that. We need to focus on standardization. We need to focus on PD. And really, what the board is focused on is what is the timeline and the rollout implementation to make sure that the kinks that we've noticed and the parents and teachers and students have recognized and brought to our attention are worked out, so that next fall we can move forward and not have these same issues. And
okay, we've got a lot to get through, yeah, sure. So let's move on. Sure. The board heard from Melinda Wright. She's selling a strategic dashboard program. Basically, I think this accompanies Powered School and the Canvas systems. That's a way for students to maintain their school experiences in a format, lets them upgrade their grades, their extracurricular and community activities. A lot going on in the school district right now. We've got master planning. We've got, you know, a new grading system. We've got fee and budget discussions. Superintendent, what prompted the district to invite this presentation?
Right. So
is there something missing in what we've got now?
Right. So what Melina presented to us is really, remember, the board and the superintendent cabinet, we work on the system, not really in the system, right? We're kind of working on how things, the vision, the horizon. And so what Melina provided for us is that horizon or that future view. So whether or not it's that program in particular, it was to give a visualization of what the future of transcripts look like for students and for learners. Because if we can see what that picture is, I think that helps us even understand there's a place for grades, there's a place for standards attainment, there's a place for where you do your whole child well-rounded experiences, your awards, your recognitions, your extracurriculars, your athletics. So there's a way to house this and display it. And it's basically a college resume. But in the past or currently, kids have to keep that on their own. This would provide a way to have a visualization for parents. It also has a lot in the back end that the administrators are going to be looking at today, which really empowers this look at student growth and student gains and attainment.
Yeah, so basically, I mean, it's a one payment fee kind of thing, and then we own it. And,
right.
Okay. And
right.
How much? What's the cost on it?
You know, we didn't do an RFP at this point yet. We, like I said, we just wanted to see a visualization of that first and see if that's the direction that the district hopes to go. I also love that strategic dashboard component because that makes visible and explicit to the community where we're headed rather than having laminated posters in the boardroom, which we currently do.
And then just with the few meetings left to be held, the board winding down the master planning process, let's see, April 16th, the final presentation of options being given to the board. May 21st was a decision-making day. Consultants, I think, telling you that don't put a hard date on that. They had hoped to see more public attendance at the input sessions. They suggested doing a survey once again once the options are presented after April 16th. So we've done two surveys. What more do we need to find out?
Well, I think once we're at the point where we see some concrete options, and there's a number of different kind of big buckets that are kind of forming. You know, one is what's going on with our early learners, you know, our preschool, and, you know, do we, you know, create a centralized hub or two centralized hubs for those kids, or do we keep them all at the elementary schools? And both of those have different costs associated with them and different options. You know, the second one would be, you know, the ninth grade going into the high school, and that's one of the most consensus things that's come out of this process so far, that people want the ninth grade to be with the high school. So that's another project that we're going to look at, and the different options that are resulting of that, which are, one, you know, building an annex to our current high school, two, building a separate, you know, a second high school to ease the size of the schools, or three, building a, you know, a totally brand new high school somewhere else. And each of those has pros and cons. Each of those has various costs associated with them. And then when you get both of those checked off, it's what do you do with the middle learners and our middle school kids? And the other consensus opinion is that seventh and eighth should be together. And so the thought is, okay, do you, you know, build a wing at Ecker and put the sixth grade there? Or do you have two middle schools? Those are kind of the two options. And again, each of these choices has explicit costs with them. And I think what's going to happen is as we roll these out in April, these different options that are the product of months and months of community outreach and project work with our educators and our community members, it'll be very clear to people, okay, these are the options, these are the costs associated with them. And then as a community, we can decide how much do we want to spend and over what timeline, and how do we want to fund this?
Sure.
And
so where do those options list? Because, I mean, I've gone through all of the minutes that are at least posted.
Those are going to come out in April, and those are going to have hopefully price tags associated with them. And it takes time to develop those, right?
But why not include some of that information in the minutes so that people can say, oh, they're considering a second high school. Let me give you input, because no way should we have it. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, that's where we're going, right? And what we wanted to do is not rush the process and allow all of the ideas that are out there to come and kind of bubble up what the best ideas are and what the consensus is from the people who have been involved in the process. And the next step in this process is going to be starting in April, which is, okay, here are our options. These are what they look like. These are the costs. Now is your chance over the next, you know, several months to give your input. And when the consultant suggested, okay, May 21st, let's not be hasty and make hard decisions. That's because, look, when we roll these out in April, in the middle of April, which is, you know, a few weeks away, it's going to take time for the community to digest the options, the costs, understand how we got to these options. And if that takes a month, great. If it takes 2 months, fine. If it takes 3 months, 6 months, that's okay too. We are not trying to rush this. We're not trying to, you know, we do want to move it forward. We don't want to stall out. However, we also recognize that any of these options are going to be costly, and it's a community decision. So we're going to be flexible with the community. We're going to make sure that everyone has ample time to give their feedback and their opinion. And we're going to do that in as many ways as possible, including town halls, surveys, trying to reach as many different people who are stakeholders in this process as possible.
Yeah. I got to ask, though, that looking at the website, it says that some 3,700 people have participated, and you've got a reach of more than 561,000 people. What does that mean? And who are these numbers? Because that really is just baffling to me.
I think I know, right, in our small community, if you click in, there's actually a description of how those different numbers are calculated. And really, that's looking at reach. So it's looking at the reach of social media. It's looking at how many hits the different articles are getting. So it could be one person, you know, looking at things repeatedly. It's not necessarily individuals. It's the different aggregation of the outreach efforts across multiple, you know, venues, everything from people that logged in to visit the website to people who signed in at any of these meetings.
So am I only counted once, even though I've been on the website 80 times?
No, you'd be 80. You'd be 80, exactly.
You're our number one viewer. So
researcher.
Thank you, Leslie.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, I'm accused of reporting misleading numbers when I reported the makeup of the steering committee. And I mean, I just pulled that information off of the website, you know, that the 19 members, these are who they are, these are who they work for, these are the community at large members. And I'm accused of misleading, but when you say that this has a reach of more than 500,000 people, I mean, I'm going to counter that and say that's very misleading.
That's why the actual description of how that's aggregated is actually a click away. So you can actually click on and see.
Okay, you're counting Park City Television that broadcasts to the Salt Lake Valley area. I mean, those people aren't interested.
Yeah, look, I think we could sit here and argue. We could argue about whether or not, you know, 3,700 participation hits or attendances are relevant. What I would say is to the community who's listening is we need more input. We need more people to come out and give our views. And we hope that once there are concrete, you know, concrete options and numbers associated with that, will get a lot more participation and interest, because I think it's very hard to talk about things in, you know, in theory and very fuzzy, soft ways until you actually know what the costs are and what the buildings will look like. And so we would implore everyone who's listening to this to come forward and, you know, start paying very close attention, because over the next several months and over the next year, we're going to be making decisions with the community, and the community is going to be making the decisions, I should say, of what this is going to look like, and it's your tax dollars, right? So, you know, the what's on the website, how many people have hit it, how many people television has reached or our social media blasts has reached, you're right, is only so relevant, right? Because at the end of the day, we have a lot of folks in this community who pay taxes who we still need to get out and talk to. And that's going to be our job as an administration and board over the next several months.
Yeah. I want to ask you real quickly, too, just about the, because we've heard from a couple of steering committee members basically telling us that they had committed not to talk to the media. And I guess that sounds like a gag order to me. Why was this set up like this? And I can go back to the minutes of December 18th when this was rolled out. Basically, the only people the media can talk to are you and I think Melinda.
No, so I don't believe that's the case. I mean, we have two committee members who are spokespeople.
Who are they?
That's Jody Fay and Joanne Funseth. And they have been speaking to the media. I've seen their quotes in the Park Record, certainly. They were selected so that there would be one voice from the steering committee, and so there wouldn't be confusion or misinformation. And so I think, you know, perhaps there's some confusion there, but there's certainly no gag order. The meetings are broadcast, the minutes are broadcast, there's videos. We're certainly not trying to make it, anything less than as transparent as possible. So it's that's just not the case. And I think you can speak to them or speak to anyone who's been involved in the process and get their views and opinions. I mean, it's a public process. There's no point in trying to hide anything. There's nothing to, there's no advantage in that for the district.
I wanted to bring up quickly that Todd Hauber, pretty excited about the 4% increase to the weighted pupil unit, about $800,000 new dollars to the school district. This money's used for school operations. It'll help pay for the teacher raises and the wellness and safety efforts that we implemented. Does this mean that we won't need to raise taxes by $5 million, or we don't know that yet?
No, there'll be a tax increase, and that was planned when we raised salaries for all of our employees. It wasn't just teachers. It was our administrators. It was all of our classified employees on the last contract negotiations, and we burned into our reserve, and we did that on purpose, and then we raised taxes last year, and there'll be a tax increase. What the amount, the actual final amount is, we're still working on that through the budget process. What we had budgeted already was that 4% increase. So Todd tends to be a pretty good predictor of what this is. He has his finger on the pulse. We did receive an extra couple $100,000 for the TSSA funding. So that's going to help. But there's a lot of other things out there that we're still trying to work through, such as our school fees and what the implications of that are. And, you know, there's going to be some variables. What's different this year is that the superintendent hasn't requested a ton of new personnel. She's actually being very efficient and cost conscious in terms of how we're reshuffling personnel to meet our needs, as opposed to just adding new people. So it's not a real increase in budget year over year. It's more still paying for the things that we did several years ago.
Yeah, I had hoped to talk to you about the reorganization or restructuring of it, but we're out of time, so I've got to leave it there. Andrew Kaplan, Jill Gaudet, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks,
thank
Leslie.
You.
Park City Council meets tomorrow to hear about a strategy update on our drinking water quality, as well as a summary of the Council's strategic planning retreat. In the studio with details, I have City Manager Diane Foster, Public Utilities Director Clint McAfee, and I'm not sure of your official title, but it has to do with water quality, Michelle DeHaan. In work session, a 30-minute discussion on the drinking water update. One line in that report, Michelle, caught my attention. What happened back in Park City in 2007 and again in 2010, very similar to what recently happened in Sandy City, where there was a release of arsenic, manganese, thallium, mercury, and lead into our drinking water. This happened into the Thames and Iron Canyon neighborhoods. So have we figured that out? Won't happen again?
Good morning, Leslie. The short answer is yes. You know, our mission here is to ensure safe drinking water for the community. And when that occurred in 2007, 2010, The city took it very seriously and really invested in technology and high quality professional staff that understand water quality. And what we've figured out is that, you know, we know the water quality in our system and we understand it. We know how to monitor for it. And we have done a very good job in ensuring that this does not happen again.
Yeah, so what we've put into place is some kind of corrosion control practice. And that, you know, it's stuff that I don't really understand. But, I mean, what I read is that we're putting a lot more chlorine in the water.
Yeah, that's correct. So there's two things we do to control the potential for metals released in our distribution system. And one is that we have a very active flushing program. And the goal of that is to remove any loose metal scale from the distribution system, like iron is an example. And then the other practice that we have is our corrosion control practice that's been published recently, including data from our system, where if we have high chlorine residual levels or higher than what some water systems might have, but moderate, and considering a lot of water systems throughout the United States, then we can actually have those firm metal scales remain on the pipe walls. And that's a very important strategy that we have been able to measure and prove is working well for our system.
Okay, so it stays on the wall until we go out and do the one-way flushing of it?
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then all that water gets flushed to the water treatment plant, and then it's all dealt with there at Spiro?
It's actually flushed out to the sewer district is the primary receiver of that, some of that water. And then we do dechlorinate because, you know, it will often go into our local streams as well.
Okay, that's what I was wondering. So the water that we end up drinking doesn't have that high chlorine in it?
The water that does, it does have the chlorine concentration that we put in from the treatment plants. And that chlorine residual is very much compliant with drinking water regulations.
Okay, even though it's at
a little bit higher level than what a traditional groundwater system would be. And because we are a surface water system, we do have to have moderate concentrations of chlorine anyhow, but it helps mitigate any challenges that we could have in the distribution system.
Okay, so we've got it figured out then.
Yep, we do.
Clint, wanted to ask you another water-related topic, includes the Jordan Hills Special Services District Maintenance Agreement. Park City currently pays the Special Service District $250,000 every year to do what?
That's our budget for the mine maintenance program. We don't necessarily pay them. We pay them on a time and materials basis. So they are, Jordan Hills Special Service Districts maintains a few of their own mine tunnels. So they have hard rock miners on staff. We contract those miners to do basic maintenance in the Judge and Spiro tunnels. We do that to keep the water coming out of those tunnels. They're a major water source for the city. So those workers are in there replacing rail, replacing old timber wood structure with steel structure, keeping ventilation safety things up to good condition.
Yeah, and what we've learned is that the Spiro Tunnel now really in poor shape, and they won't even do it. So we've got to go out and find somebody else. I mean, are there people out there that still do this?
So long term, again, the goal of every dollar we put in those mine tunnels is to produce water out of those tunnels. And safety is the number one concern in doing that. And the JSSD miners are great. However, they're basically limited to hand tools. And so we need to augment their capabilities with more of a contractor that actually, you know, would drive a brand new tunnel. They have tunnel boring machines, heavy equipment that can come in and do some of the more extensive work. So between those two contractors, that's how we're going to maintain the tunnels.
Okay. So we're not even using Judge Water at this point and won't until we get the Three Kings Water Treatment Plant online in 2022?
Correct.
Yeah, but we've got to keep the flow happening.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's 100-year-old plus or minus 100-year-old tunnels. You know, you got to keep maintaining these. If you let it go too far, it becomes dangerous and expensive.
So more than a third of the city's water supply comes from these two tunnels. And this untreated tunnel water, we're using it for snowmaking, golf course irrigation, creek flows. So I guess I'm just curious. I mean, if it's not water that can go into the creeks, mm-hmm. why are we putting it on our hillsides and on our golf courses? I mean, somewhere it's got to be treated. Isn't that stuff just going to flow out into the stormwater or into the creeks eventually?
Yeah, so so now we're getting into the Clean Water Act. So the Clean Water Act regulates discharge into waters of the U.S. And these two sources have been discharging for, again, plus or minus 100 years. You know, and there's higher than what the standard calls for in with certain metals. And we're under order with the Division of Water Quality to eventually comply with those standards. But, you know, it's a huge financial investment for the community, and so we're taking it slow. We just finalized an amendment to an order from the state that actually gives us more leeway. And between the city and the State Division of Water Quality, we're comfortable. We're achieving a really good balance between protecting aquatic life and, you know, that financial burden on the city.
All right. So even though we're putting it onto our ski slopes, I mean, that's okay. I mean, it eventually gets filtered out somehow, or?
I mean, it's we are putting, you know, water that contains low levels of both dissolved and particulate metals up on the mountain. But this is, you know, those metals are what have come out of the mountain in the first place. So, again, you know, I think we achieved that balance of protecting both human health and aquatic life.
All right. And I was just curious, who pays for the liability insurance for the special service district folks that go into those mine tunnels? Is that something that the city has to absorb?
JSSD, you know, that's built into the rate that we pay them.
Okay. Wanted to talk a little bit about the lease of surplus water from Park City to Weber Basin. And I'm thinking that this was water that we leased from Weber Basin. So now we're releasing it back to them.
Part of that water, yes, is leased from the Bureau of Reclamation and Weber Basin. I would say roughly, you know, 30-40% of our water supply comes from that source. But yeah, this is part of a 2013 agreement called the Western Summit County Project. And the purpose of that agreement was to ensure adequate water supply for the Snyderville Basin. There's a projected shortfall in water supply as growth happens in the basin, and the three parties, Summit Water, Mountain Regional, and Park City, got together and with Weber Basin to develop a solution to that, both short-term and long-term. And the short-term solution is basically to, I guess, for lack of better words, equalize the water supply in the basin. So right now, Summit Water needs water. Park City has a little surplus water, you know, extra water currently. So in the short term, we can lease that until we need it for our own community.
Yeah, so what's the case with that, with Summit Water? I mean, did they just take on a bunch more development or new applications or something?
Yeah.
Because they used to be, they didn't even conserve water at some point.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long story. The short story is they're... current reliable supply is definitely lower than what they need, and they have no other alternative than to subscribe for water from Weber Basin, and Park City is now one of the suppliers to Weber Basin to give Weber Basin that water. The long term, once you know demand in the entire basin exceeds available supply, the solution there is for Weber Basin to basically develop a new water source. You know, we've talked about that's where Round Valley Reservoir could come into play, East Canyon Pipeline, a new pipeline from Rockport Reservoir. So really the city staff and council has two goals with leasing this surplus water. One, to augment our revenues to help our current ratepayers, and two, to delay that project because it's going to cost the community a lot of money.
$70 to $100 million is what was reported.
Yeah, and you know, these days you take those estimates and add 30% at least. It's a challenging construction environment right now.
Okay, so city water rate users, though, we're not losing out on this deal, right? I mean, we paid for the water already. Now we're going to lease it back at a higher cost, or
we priced. So think of it as we're basically just extending our customer base. You know, so we're increasing the number of customers available to pay for all the costs associated, including treating the Judge and Spiro tunnels. And we priced that water in council. This was important to council that what we sell it for is roughly equivalent to what our current ratepayers are paying.
Okay. So what do we know about Weber Basin's plans? I mean, have they moved forward on whether or not we look at building a pipeline from East Canyon Reservoir or building some kind of storage facility?
They have very much been waiting to see what Park City is going to do. You know, given those two goals of keeping rates down and delaying that big project, Park City Council has decided they would like to lease that water. So Weber Basin is not planning on building anything. When they do, and if they do, Park City very much has a seat at that table, especially when it comes to any infrastructure on our own property, like Round Valley Reservoir. I believe we actually have the opportunity to not allow that to happen if Park City doesn't want it to happen.
Okay. Let's see. Park City launching into a full-scale planning effort, Diane, to improve traffic circulation and safety in Old Town, estimated to cost some $200,000. So what kind of improvements are we talking about here?
I think, are you looking at the Hillside Avenue report? So this is a status update for council as a staff communication report. And what it does is it actually lists all of the improvements. There's a nice table on one of the pages that talks about enhanced wayfinding. We built a bulb out. We still need to put the signage on the bulb out. We've removed certain signage at the bottom of Hillside that directs people up there. The staff has been working with the transportation and particularly the lodging companies about shuttles. So there's a number of things that happen there. As part of this effort, we'll be working on a longer-term circulation piece, because while there has been a request from a couple citizens to remove all commercial traffic from there, it is staff's belief that if we eliminate that completely, we're going to create some significant problems for other residents and for how traffic moves. So in order to provide the City Council with more information, we'll be doing a comprehensive Old Town circulation study. It's actually quite similar to what we found. You know, we had a meeting a few years ago with Sundance, and it's the one meeting I've been in with Robert Redford where he was concerned about traffic, and Dave Gustafson actually presented, along with Alfred Knotts, why keeping Main Street open during Sundance was important for circulation and what would happen if it wasn't open. So those kind of studies are really important to provide good information. Other thing, obviously, we've changed the direction of the street by the post office, and it took a little bit of getting used to, but I think this week the crews did the restriping on the how things are parked. So a lot happening on that front to really mitigate traffic. And importantly, and the residents are a fan of this, I believe we'll be bringing back the removable speed bumps. We can't keep them in place in the winter because of snow plowing. However, we can put them back in the summer, and they do help speeds a lot.
Okay, and I had one question with regard to the council's planning retreat. I mean, there was a lot there, but this one first. So, I mean, if when asked if the council remains committed to the paid parking program and the implementation of additional parking management strategy, it sounded like council said yes, they support more dynamic parking pricing and off-season local promos. They also support expanding residential parking permits, revisiting the circulator, and exploring taxi dispatch areas. So I guess I'm confused. I mean, it's like, well, we're going to deal with the parking pricing. I mean, do you want us to get out of our cars and ride the bus, or do you want to offer discounts so that we come to Main Street in our car?
Actually, this is an area where it doesn't usually happen in life, but we can have both. So if during the off season, inviting locals to supplement the availability of everything from restaurant seats to shopping experience in the off season. And also, it's important, the other reason that's important is China Bridge is not that expensive. So getting people to come up and realize this is not what, and except for Sundance, and even during Sundance, it's not what you're going to pay if you're in LA. However, it does manage really locals parking and leaving there. And you'll see even during the off season, you'll have more employees in China Bridge because they look at it as, oh, if I pay $6 or $7 for my shift, I think that's worth it.
Okay. We'll talk about that at another time. Diane, Michelle, Clint, thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks, Leslie.
Thanks.
And
thank you, Leslie.
I did want to just highlight for a moment, though, the reason we have Michelle on the agenda this week is because transparency around water quality is so important to the community. We don't have any issues right now, but this is telling about why we don't have any issues and the good steps that our team's taking.
Okay, thanks again.
Thank you.
Well, sign-up has started for the Park City Trails series. In the studio to tell us more about that, I have Pete Van Sloten. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So let's see. Tell us just a little bit about what the trail series is.
Sure. The Park City Trail Series is a summer trail running series here in Park City. It's out in the Round Valley area, out by the National Ability Center, and the ice rink is where our start and finish lines are. There's four races in the series. They start with a 5K in June, and then in July there's a 10K. In August there's a 15K, and then we finish in September with a half marathon.
Okay. And people pay one fee and then get to do everything? Or?
Correct. Yeah. We have a limited number of slots for individual race registrations for each different distance. We try to encourage people to register for all four races. So currently it's about $145 and you get all four of those races.
Okay. So that's just the races. I mean, you also do some trail running together? Or yeah. Coaching or?
Yeah. So the series is currently owned by the Salt Lake Running Company, and we do some training groups out of there. We do Wednesday trail runs in preparation for the series. We also kind of work with our vendors and sponsors, and they put on some individual events in that summer time frame that are tied with the series.
Okay, so are the trail running events held then in the Salt Lake Valley, or are they up here?
No, they're all of the trail runs are here in Park City.
Okay, so people can get all of this somewhere on the website?
Correct, yeah. Our website is pctrailseries.com. And there's a link there to register and also see the course maps and learn about just more about the event.
Okay. Is that the goal? I mean, is that where you see some success when you start telling people just start with a 5K? A month later, you'll be able to double that?
You know, each athlete is individual and their motivations are a little different. We recommend that people start at the 5K and go all the way up. Our series is unique in Utah, and kind of as in trail running in general, we're in an era of ultra marathons, 100-mile races, and you know, people who have been running for a long time are really aspiring to do those. And we find ourselves on the other end where, you know, for our 5K last year, in our post-race survey, 35% of people said that was their first trail race ever of that distance. So we pride ourselves on having a fantastic event for, you know, competitive athletes, but we also love to be an entry point into trail running. Trail running right now is one of the fastest growing segments in the running industry, so people are really enjoying getting off of the pavement and out onto the dirt.
Yeah. When does the weekly trail run start? I guess once the mud's gone?
Yeah. You know, we're currently doing Wednesday evening road runs, and then we'll transition to the trail as it gets warmer and drier. We try to stay off of the trails while they're still damp just to, you know, avoid damage.
Yeah. Do you need two different pairs of shoes for that?
That's a common question that we get with brand new trail runners. So road running shoes have a little less traction, I would say. They're meant for, you know, real even flat surface. And a dedicated trail running shoe will have a little bit more traction for sticking to rocks. They have a little bit bigger lugs for gripping in dust and dirt and whatnot. And maybe just a little bit more support for, you know, when you might roll over, have uneven terrain.
Okay. So I think the cost now through the end of the month, $145?
That's correct, yep.
Okay, and it's pctrailsseries.com.
Correct, yeah.
Okay, anything else you want to mention, Pete?
No, we just love to have everybody out. And we will be putting out a call for volunteers. So if there's some locals who are not runners or you'd like to come out and support a friend, about a month before the races, we will have our volunteer slots available to sign up for.
Okay. And the races typically take place on the weekend?
Yep. All of our races are Saturday mornings. Our start time is all, we make it a point to start on time at 8 a.m. And for Park City residents, we will have a special packet pickup before the race. We try to knock out as many as possible in Salt Lake the day before. But for Park City residents, they can come out just before the race and pick up their bib.
Okay. Hey, Pete, thanks.
Thank you.
It's Pete Van Sloten with Park City Trail Series.